द्वैताद्वैत महामोह सर्वरीक्षपणक्षम भास्वानिव जयते को गणेशो दूतरीयुत प्रतिभायाः परोल्लासो निशाकर इवापरः दूतीयुक्तः सजयतु बटुकस्तांडवान्वितः ओम शांतिः शांतिः शांतिः। This wonderful topic, shrines and collective consciousness. It's very timely. Power of collective consciousness is known to the entire human race. Business community knows it. They tap into it to succeed in commerce. Political community knows it. They tap it into it to succeed in politics. Religious leaders know it, and they tap into it to succeed in their religious activities. What is important here with this evening, what we are going to discuss, is a very unique kind of consciousness that we are talking about. Where people do not pay much attention to it. So far, nowhere in human history I hear any spiritual teacher, spiritual leader talking about collective consciousness and its importance as clearly and, you know, strongly as Gautam Buddha and Jesus Christ. Gautam Buddha, first thing he said, Buddham Saranam Gacchami. You know, and definitely he's not talking about himself, because at that time he was not known as Buddha. Buddha became Buddha. It took several hundred years before he became Buddha. Okay? Came to be known as Buddha. His real name is, of course, Siddhartha. No? Childhood name before he left the world and joined the spiritual path. And in the first mention of him as something different than Siddhartha, is Shakya Muni, the great sage from Shakya clan. That's his real name, Shakya Muni. So when you go to China, you go to Tibet, you go to Japan, Korea, you know, in all these places, he is more known as Shakya Muni. Then Buddha is a title of any enlightened person. Anybody who reaches that state of realization is called Buddha. Buddha means fully awakened one. A person who is able to understand himself and is able to understand others. We are not so prompt, responsive, on time, in right manner, while using the right language, because we do not understand others. In our family, if our family is made of four people, five people, we'll be able to act properly and appropriately when we understand ourselves and understand all the members of the family. It is only in proportion to how much we understand others will be able to respond, interact, and communicate with others. Similarly, it is only when we understand actual human problems, human issues, will be able to act accordingly, provided we have right intention, we really mean it. Quite often, we know the problems, we understand what the other person is struggling with or is in need of, and yet we do not care. Therefore, we do not act accordingly. Sometimes we have good intention, but we don't know what the problems are, therefore we do not act accordingly, properly. So, this is what very first thing Buddha, as a part of his ground rules of living in the ashram life, or fundamental rules that governed the spiritual path or spiritual teachings of Buddha, was Buddham Saranam Gacchami. I take refuge in Buddha, the enlightened one. First thing that we must learn is how to avoid not seeking guidance, those who are more confused than we are. If somebody is as asleep as I am, how can I expect that a sleeping person will wake me up and put me on the right path? No? Therefore, we go to Buddha, somebody who is awakened and knows how to wake up others, how to awaken others. Now, that Buddha says, Buddham Saranam Gacchami. Then he said, Dhammam Saranam Gacchami. This is a prayer, like we do our prayer. Om Asat Om Asad Gamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotir Gamaya Mrityor Ma Amritam Gamaya. Buddha said, Buddham Saranam Gacchami, Dhammam Saranam Gacchami, then Sangham Saranam Gacchami. I seek to find shelter in the awakened ones, in dharma, in righteousness, honesty and truth. I seek shelter in sangha, in collective consciousness, which is translated as organization, church, no, institute. No, it's not. Sangham. You are one, all of us are one gana, one individual, one entity, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 100. Okay? Together we are Sangha, sharing one collective consciousness. Even though our individual consciousness is right here, fully intact, when you are here, it doesn't mean your individuality is totally gone, destroyed, finished, and has lost its charm. No. But rather, what is there? That we are here with a common purpose, with a common goal, and we are seeking in a very unified manner. Our search is very unified. No. That unified search is toward very, very unified, well-defined goal and objective. That consciousness called Sangha, Sangham Saranam Gacchami. 500 years later, very brief statement, perhaps a good amount of might have been lost, where he says, where two or more people sit in my name, a church is built. But unless those two or more people sit, sitting together is not that hard and that easy. You know, running away from each other is much easier. In order to practice divisiveness, we don't need to work very hard. There's lots of tamas, lots of ignorance, lots of asmita, distorted sense of self-identity is there, lots of attachment, lots of aversion, hatred, lots of fear. These afflictions are there, and they are so well rooted that we really don't need to work hard to awaken them and grow them further and invest them further. They themselves are doing their job. In fact, they employ our mind and soul. So we are employees, we are, you know, in the form of pleasure and pain, we are being paid for working for all these afflictions. These afflictions are our bosses. That's how the things have become. No? We have become slaves to our own deep-rooted habit patterns. Belief system, the beliefs whose validity we have never ever tried to examine. We are prisoners of our own habit patterns, habits. Therefore, we don't need to work very hard. It's just by being kind of careless, disinterested, just simple disinterest in actively doing something good automatically feeds our energy to do something bad. And there is a rule, there is a very powerful, you know, law, of physics. It takes less energy for a chaotic change to occur. It takes lots of energy, you know, the energy that takes to build a house is far more than the energy it takes for that house to crumble. It's very simple law, you know. Because in order to create, things have to be very methodical. You know? Very methodical. Every single brick has to be arranged properly. Foundation has to be laid properly. You know? And with such hard work after such a long time, then a beautiful structure is created. As soon as you just simply stop visiting that structure, as soon as you stop taking care of that structure, automatically structure starts decaying, deteriorating. The process of decay requires far less energy than process of creation. And that is why we need to be actively engaged in creating a collective consciousness that has a purpose, that has a meaning, and that has capacity to enlighten others and hold everyone together. The collective consciousness which is of disruptive nature does not need that much attention, that much skill. And this is where the idea of shrine comes in. Normally we think that you created a building, and you invited some celebrity to unveil the statue or inaugurate or do the ribbon cutting, and you had media there, photos were taken, posted on Facebook, and shrine is built. Actually, it's called a structure is built, not a shrine is built. Shrine is something more than just a physical location. When you go to the Himalayas, there are many, many wonderful places. There you do not see very, very fabulous or very impressive structures. There are just mountains, valleys, rocks. One of the most unimpressive shrine, for example, is Kedarnath, at around 12,000 feet. Very, very sacred shrine in the Himalayas. Do you know what is that shrine made of? A funny looking rock. Here we hear about Shiva Lingam. People worship Shiva Lingam. This oval shape structure that is now normally has become associated with Lord Shiva. That shrine, Kedarnath in the Himalayas, is shrine associated with Shiva, but there is no Shiva Lingam in it. It's just a rock. Then you wonder, what is so special about it? And temple, small temple standing there for it. God knows, 300 years, 500 years, 1,000 years. Architecturally, it is not very fantastic kind of structure. And for 6 months every year, it's closed. In the winter time, it's closed. And officially, the divinity of that shrine is brought down in lower locations, lower elevation. But the truth is that real shrine, real statue, real stuff, sacred emblem, is an unmoving rock. God knows how big is that. Just tip of the rock is popping out of the ground. So rock just stays there, never moves to the lower elevation. Okay? It is just closed. And closed, what will you close? Even the doors don't work there. No? That is a shrine. If I tell you, stories of that shrine and miraculous things that I have seen there, it is shocking. And yet, it is just a very simple structure. Why it is a shrine? Place in eastern part of India called Kamakhya. Now they have a temple, but most of the shrines, there are many, many, many shrines, and most of them still don't have very big temple or anything, just a hole in the ground, and you go underground, and it's a very scary kind of steep steps going into inside. Rocks, they have just cut the rocks, and you have to walk very carefully. Visit that place before you are 90 years old. Meaning it's hard to go there. Nothing glamorous. In fact, it is, for our modern mind, it is anti-glamorous. Still, there are animal sacrifices. She's a goddess of mercy, love, and compassion. And you have to sacrifice an animal to appease her? It doesn't make any sense. You have this feeling when you are there, but still you do not know what is drawing you. And just few months later, you want to go back again to the same very place which you did not really, which did not really match with your philosophy of life. Why? What is so special about it? So that is a shrine. Now let us see how these shrines came to be. The origin may be shrouded in mystery. I do not know exactly. There are times when it's very difficult to say. Whole mountain is described, let's say, certain mountain. It's called Neelachal, whole mountain. It's a hill, not very big mountain. Let's take an example of this eastern part of India, Kamakhya, outside town called Guwahati, shrine of Divine Mother, and several, many manifestations of the Divine Mother. That is one of the stronghold of tantric practices in India. There are stories of the pertaining to the origin of that shrine. And those stories are hard to believe today in our modern times. Such as a sage who emerged from the mind of Brahmaji, the creator, came to do his tapas there. The story can go on and on and on. Right from the very beginning, you are bewildered. Somebody just came up, popped out of God's mind and became a sage. What was he doing there? Doing his tapas, meditation, The way whole thing is described, it's just doesn't make very much sense to those who have cultivated their reason and intellect. In our modern times, our reason and intellect are very important. That we must cultivate in order to succeed in life. Idea of cultivating your heart, feelings of your heart, means you are working hard to become a gullible person. Doesn't make much sense. But this is a shrine. What happens there? For long time, people are different categories, people of one particular type of mindset, philosophy, they have done their sadhana practice with very unique intention. So for example, in that hill, there is one shrine completely at the top. There are many shrines. The most famous shrine is the biggest temple these days. That's where majority of the people go and do their pilgrimage and worship. And then there are many other smaller spots here and there. And one spot is completely at the top called Bhuvaneshwari. Well, long time ago, that means in 1977, it just so happened I lived there for an extended period of time and did my practice. So I know those so many places, all the details of that whole hill is in my head. It is something, I have been told that it is something, it's called Navamundi Asan, where there are 9 different kinds of consciousness dwell here, signified by 9 different heads. Then that person explained something about Navamundi Asana, a place, a vortex of intelligent energy, fully conscious, self-aware, Shakti, that combines 9 different unique ways of manifesting in this universe, including in our own body and mind. What does it mean? A group of sadhus invoke the divinity in 9 different manners for nine different broad reasons. And practice must have continued for a long, long time, and it must have taken several generations. Now that's what makes it a shrine. There you can build a temple made of marble, you can build a temple made of quartz, you can build a temple made of gold, you can build a temple made of rocks. You can build something very big, you can build something very small, or you don't build anything there. The space is there. Okay? That space is called shrine. Whatever happens to fall within the range of the energy corresponding to that space, automatically that particular thing, that particular individual also becomes charged with that energy. That is called shrine. How does it happen? It happens because of extreme concentration of collective consciousness of one nature. People talk about Wharton School of Business of University of Pennsylvania. And there's assumption. You go to UPenn, you go to Harvard, go to Stanford, Princeton University, Yale. It's like assumption is that one day you will emerge as something, as someone. So that energy is there. That's Allahabad University, this is Oxford, this is UPenn, this is Harvard, this is Yale, and this is this. There is something very unique about it. And Varanasi, for example, there is a story about that time to time, sometimes these stories, God knows how much they are referring to the truth, but so definitely they are trying to convey a message. That once upon a time, when our solar system was completely, gone, finished, destroyed, it was just an empty space, and lots of forces from the neighboring systems, solar systems, they were trying to just grab a part of it. So when a country, when a nation becomes weak, then that's when the people from all over, they start coming and grabbing it. So that was the situation of the solar system. At that time, one of the immortals says, who is not dependent on a physical body as a locus in order to maintain his self-awareness. One who is capable of using the pure space or the air or the light as locus, as a body, to move around. His name is Narada, N-A-R-A-D-A. Sage Narada was passing through this vast space. While he was still a few million miles away from a particular spot in the space, he felt extreme pull. He went in that direction, and it is just pure space. It's like suddenly he's delighted. It's like he had just met one of his most beloved member of his own family or friend. And he was so kind of moved deep inside. How may I communicate? How may I address to this awareness? It's like my own soul. What is this? That is when his older brother, Sanat Kumara, and these are great, great sages in Indian literature, great sage Sanat Kumara came, assumed some kind of form which can be identified as Sanat Kumara. So he asked, "Are Narad, what's the matter?" So he said, "Bhaiya, brother, this is what's going on in my head. Can you tell me? You are the most ancient soul who has been maintaining his identity since the eternity. Can you tell me, why am I drawn to this place? Why my soul is so overwhelmed here? I'm like drowning in a ocean of joy." Then Sanat Kumar said, "Long time ago, this particular space was occupied by earth. And exactly the spot where you are drawn to was once, that's where the Varanasi used to be. And this is where you have lived for many, many, many years, and you have gone through lovely experiences. So there is a natural affinity to this place. And whenever, during the next cycle of the creation, the sun evolves and the planets are created, that's where the Varanasi is going to be again during the next cycle of the creation." So Varanasi is one of the most ancient cities in the world. Repeatedly, again and again and again, the city is destroyed and the Ganges changes its. Even there was a time when Ganges did not exist there. Even scriptures talk about the time when Ganga did not exist in Varanasi and Allahabad. And still Varanasi existed there as Anandavan, Abhimukta Kshetra. You know, those names were different. That, you know, jungle of joy, jungle of bliss. And that's where, you know, tens of thousands of ashrams existed. And today we have a hard time believing such things. But it should not be that hard. You go to a place in central Burma called Bagan. In a concentrated place on the bank of River Irrawaddy. Still there are around 2,372 temples still intact. You climb the roof of one of the temples and you see as far as your eyes can go. It's just temples, temples, temples and temples. And the history tells that there are more than 5,000 temples at a time. And in order to support that many, and some of the temples are not small. At least there we saw more than 50 temples, maybe 100 temples, much bigger than the biggest temple of Khajuraho. That big. And in order to support that many, because you don't just build a temple and just leave. It means there must have been, it was a city of temples. And city of temples means roads, streets, people to take care of those temples, people to practice, people to do puja there. And that means universities, colleges, you know, all dedicated, all moving in one direction, that is spiritual wisdom, learning about spirituality. So it happened just only 1,000 years ago. Okay. And still evidence is there. So building a whole city just for one particular purpose, that's not impossible. Okay, not impossible. So people have made that efforts in the past. Today, you are smart. and you are great. If you could happen to start a company in your garage and one day it becomes a multi-billion dollar company. You are a great soul. Because today you have billion plus customers and you have capacity to shake even the biggest of the governments of the planet because of that power of connectivity, data gathering, data processing. Okay? Our consciousness is going in that direction. And remember, there is collective consciousness involved even in that process. When Albert Einstein came up with his formula of atomic science, do you know that he was probably just a few hours ahead of everybody else? That's it. Okay? People in China, people in India, people in Japan, people in Europe. You know? Right time, right place, right methodology, right luck. Someone becomes father of nuclear science. No? But in collective consciousness, whole planet was actually enveloped by, you know, the whole planet was enveloped by that collective consciousness that was waiting for this knowledge to manifest. Seeds were scattered everywhere. Wherever the soil was more fertile, boom, here comes atomic energy. People did not need to beg the United States of America or Princeton University to get into nuclear science. In fact, very many countries and very many organizations were working very hard to stop it. A powerful nation like United States of America and rest of the whole world together, it has not been able to stop North Korea to do this kind of job. Why is that? Collective consciousness. Okay? Collective consciousness. Look at the other side. Few of us, like fireflies here and there, talk about peace in a very discoordinated fashion. Even if there are 7 billion tiny, tiny fireflies, no matter how discoordinated they are, still, if they start blinking together, they can illuminate at least one football field. That's how, in fact, the Dutch people navigated through the river and went into the interiors of some of the islands of Indonesia. Because in the night time, there are so many night flies that was the best time to enter the jungle. Because in the daytime, those aborigines sitting there with tiny, tiny, you know, arrow and bow, you know, they are sitting on the top of the tree, and all they could do, and then arrow goes into the body of the Dutch. So entering that jungle in the daytime was hard. Entering that jungle in the night time was hard too, because it was too dark. But entering the jungle in the light of fireflies, read the history. 10 million fireflies illuminated the space. And these people just rode their boat, they reached there. But the thing is here, it's concentrated, coordinated, well-defined, well-structured, well-organized effort in creating a particular type of collective consciousness. Only then it will be able to neutralize and nullify the collective consciousness that is running our world amok. What does shrines do? You build a place. Do your sadhana. Do your practice. One day that place will emerge as a shrine. Kumar Jiva and some other great saints from India, they went to China somewhere in 4th century AD, 1600 years, 1700 years ago. When they arrived there, their master sent, go there, teach. Language barrier, culture barrier, no? And solve all problems. 7 years. This great yogi sat facing a wall out of pity, compassion. Once in a while, somebody gave some food. It took 7 years before first person ever came to study with this yogi. Look at the power of resolution this yogi had. Look at the dedication and commitment he had. Look at the faith he had in his own master. Look at the intensity of his love and compassion for teaching suffering people. Everything together, if you put together, this one person was much bigger and more powerful, you know, in terms of his more effective, 1,000 times more effective than any other person. That is where the first school of Buddha's teaching began. Shakyamuni Buddha went while hiding himself in the heart of this great soul, Kumara Jiva. And that particular place in central China is treated as one of their most sacred places. And even this powerful cultural revolution that destroys so much of Chinese culture has not been able to make a dent on the sacred nature of and sanctity of that space. Okay? That's power of collective consciousness. And this is how a shrine is born. Shrine is an embodiment of collective consciousness, of very unique nature, super unique nature. Many of you have been to Khajuraho. Even the very, very first time, around, let's say, 35, 36 days before the actual so-called Prana Pratishtha consecration. Consecration was supposed to be on January 30th of 2013. But for some reason, I looked at and I found out that December 25th, Christmas Day, was the best time to invoke the Shakti. Things which had happened, it just blows away our mind. Around 15, 20 of us were there, you know, people from Huntsdale, two people from Houston, and so we started, we went into our Garbhagriha, a shrine that we had brought from Mount Kailas in Tibet. One sacred rock sits in our shrine here in Huntsdale, another in Khajuraho. When we started doing our recitation, invocation, it wasn't even so-called official Prana Pratishtha, the consecration. It was just a prayer coming from the heart of our heart. And there was You call it craziness, blind faith, or whatever you call it, but I know what my monastery is all about, our ancestral cave in Mount Kailas in Trans-Himalayas in Western Tibet. What that sacred rock really means. And I also know that whether I know anything or not, just because I've been accepted as child of these masters, my prayers are always fully heard by those great souls. I do not need to know too much, too many books, too many scriptures. If I know, that's fine. If I don't know, that's fine too. We started. And in the middle of the prayer, maybe toward the end of the long, 30-minute long recitation, I felt something unique in the space inside that room, underground cave. But I kept myself composed. When I opened my eyes, that rock, the face of the rock had changed by itself. I looked at Ishan, who was sitting next to me. I said, "Ishan, do you see something?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Who is he?" He said, "Bhagwan Dakshinamurti." I said, "How do you know?" He said, "Because he's facing south." It was so thrilling to me that it's bizarre feeling. It's like joy, and sometimes in that microseconds time, so many things come. A feeling came at that time, such like the joy I was unable to contain, and in that lack of my ability to contain, even a thought came that even if I die right at this moment, the work of Swamiji is secured. His work is secured. If Ishan can see this rock, and he can exactly see what happened, and if he can exactly know who is that soul in this rock, then everything else will come from there. He's the primordial sage of the tradition, Bhagavan Dakshinamurti. In that moment, even the worst of the situations of life came riding the wave of joy. Oh, even if I die, it's not a big deal. Somebody is there to continue the work. You know? What does it mean? That level of realization and that level of shakti, that level of shrine, that level of somebody making that shrine as his own residence, that means even 1,000 ill-behaved, foolish teachers at the Himalayan Institute cannot destroy Himalayan Institute. It means a teacher could be good, a teacher could be bad, but teachings are bound to remain intact. Wow. It means I don't have to worry about my own stupidity. I don't have to worry about others' stupidity. There is much higher force. Okay? And this shrine embodies that force. Purpose is accomplished. That's what happens there. Similarly, here many things we are planning for Hansdale. Shrine, as you may see, same thing. When we do our sadhana, our intention is correct. Methodology will present itself to us in proportion to our intention. See here how the shrine and how the collective consciousness work. Your intention has to be correct. What are you trying to accomplish? Whatever you are trying to accomplish, do you see any degree of selfishness in it? If there is any degree of selfishness, then it means it has taken away some of the virtue, some of the, the purity of it is gone. Do you see some degree of ego in it? Are you trying to be a big star, a hero? If that is the case, something is missing. Definitely something will miss there. So that's what the force behind building a shrine is very important, and that force has to be pure and clean. And then that force has to be concentrated. It has to be made concentrated by our collective efforts. When your intention is correct, try your best to use the right kind of methodology. Try your best not to distort the methodology. And if there is anywhere you just happen to make a mistake, someone is going to just catch your hand, stop, do this way. Or it will create a situation where you are about to make a mistake and suddenly you are just picked up and put over there, and therefore you lost the opportunity to make the mistake. Automatically it happens. Then you do your own preparation, right kind of practice. Of course, each individual is different. Your comprehension, my background, your background, there are some differences, and yet our intentions are similar and the same. We are trying to do the same thing. With that intention, we invite the sages, we invite the masters, we invite the great forces of water, fire, air, sky. We invite the forces of Maitri, Karuna, Mudita, Upeksha, the forces which manifest in us in the form of friendliness, compassion, cheerfulness, forces that manifest in us in the form of non-judging, forces which manifest in us and thus empower us to take everyone, accept, absorb, embrace everyone, and without letting the negative things, bad things you may have come to know about those whom you are trying to embrace. When these qualities are there, you have cultivated, at least you have tried your best to cultivate, and then you organize good, nice practice, long-lasting practice, where people with similar mind, similar heart, similar attitude, similar intention, gather together, do their sadhana for, let's say, 11 days, 33 days, 6 months, 1 year, 2 year, repeatedly, right at that place, automatically, that space becomes charged with that shakti. That's called the shrine that embodies the collective consciousness of unique nature. And as time passes, the range of that collective consciousness and the energy of the shrine keeps expanding. In the beginning, it may be just the shrine, or who knows, even just it may be the whole campus. Later on, little further, little further, little more, little more. That is how it becomes kshetra, a field. Buddha calls Buddha Kshetra. There is a field of Buddhahood. There is a unique field of Sri Vidya Shrine. And the whole Kshetra, whole shrine is fertile. You sit down in that field of Sri Vidya and do your practice anywhere, you will be just fine. You will see the effect. Now, you take this idea of collective consciousness and shrine to next level. Just like in India, there are certain shrines, they communicate with each other. So when I was putting together Sri Vidya Shrine in Khajuraho, I made an effort to visit certain places and invite the shaktis of those different shrines. So, for example, in our shrine in Khajuraho, there resides the Divine Mother from Kamakhya, Divine Mother from Himachal Pradesh, Madurai in South India, Vindhyavasini, Vindhyachal, etc., etc. So similarly, what will happen when we build the shrine here? will go there. Like, you know, this is what, for example, we are organizing our practice as part of Rudrayaga in 2019, in February 2019, at the bank of the Ganges. Right place, right time, right manner, right practice. To invoke the Shakti and then invite that Shakti, a requester, to reside here, you know, at our shrine here. So this way, there is a two Khajuraho, there are two Hansdales. Hansdale in Khajuraho, Khajuraho in Hansdale. Why? Because it's the manifestation of the same Shakti in two different locations. You just go there, do your sadhana. This is how sages in the olden days found that this is how they can do the best service. They can extend their love and compassion and guidance to mankind, and they can continue serving the humanity even long after they are gone. Human race is a recipient of that degree of love, gift of love, guidance, compassion, and wisdom. And not being able to remember that is very, very, what you call, sign and symptom of our carelessness, ignorance. And this has happened throughout the history. Certain cultures have somehow preserved that knowledge and find great pride and great pleasure in passing on that knowledge to successive generations. In certain cultures, people have forgotten and people don't see any pride in it. They don't find any pleasure in it. However, they find pleasure in something else. We find pleasure in passing on some other kind of knowledge, you know, and as an inheritance to our children here. Africans find something different. Chinese find that pride something else, in something else. We find our pride, our pleasure in recognizing what brings true transformation in our lives, how to preserve it, and how to pass it on. That is what is the summary of the shrines and collective consciousness. God bless you all.